Today, at the crossroads, the DFA Daily to the 10th of September 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at some of the latest signs relating to falling housing affordability, rising mortgage delinquencies, pressure on building costs, as well as the risks of a stock market shakedown and a rise in COVID variants. We are, in so many ways, at a series of complex crossroads, and while some roads may lead to prosperity, others certainly do not. So it's definitely worth reading the signs carefully. PEXA reported today that both New South Wales and Victoria saw sales settlements slip in August as the impact of each state's respective lockdowns started to bite. Victoria dropped 7.2% to 18,840 sales settlements, and New South Wales dropped 6.7% to 19,149 in August compared to the prior month. Queensland was the only state to see growth in sale settlements in August, posting an increase of 1.6% to 19,668 over July 21. This result was the highest recorded in any state in the month and continued the Sunshine State's stellar run. WA property market recovery showed signs of running out of steam, though, as the state experienced a slight drop of 2.5% to 7,636 sale agreements in August. That result is still 35.7% higher than the year prior and shows the market continues to perform well above levels observed in the lead-up to the pandemic. Elsewhere, the CEO of Westpac, Peter King, told a parliamentary committee that housing affordability in Australia is stretched and a pressing concern for the economy. Mr. King was speaking at the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics hearing into the four major banks, where he and other big four bank CEOs regularly appear. "It's at the worst levels it's been for some time," said King, of housing affordability. "When we look at housing affordability at the moment, it's pretty stretched. All asset prices have gone up with low interest rates and plenty of money in the economy. We still got more demand than supply, so that's pushing prices up." NAB's CEO Ross McEwan also addressed the issue, describing his bank's major concern about how the upward trend of house prices in Australia would eventually make home ownership difficult for Australians. And the CEOs of CBA and NZ will also appear before the committee in separate hearings in September. In the opening submission to the committee, the Westpac CEO also laid bare the scale of mortgage deferrals that his bank is currently dealing with. Currently, we have $2.75 billion worth of mortgages with repayment deferrals. To give this number some context, total deferrals last time peaked at $55 billion, read the statement. In small business loans, total deferrals are $70 million, compared to a peak of $10 billion last time. Small businesses are showing particular resilience. Some have pivoted or evolved their operations and supply chains so that they can better withstand lockdowns, he said. Now, Fitch Ratings reported that Australia's 30-day plus mortgage arrears rose by 9 basis points to 1.14 in the second quarter of 2021, largely as a result of a small subset of transactions with high payment deferrals at March 31. That's according to Fitch Ratings' latest Dinkum RMBS Index report. This data doesn't include the effects of more recent lockdowns in Sydney and the state of New South Wales, which started on the 26th of June, and Melbourne and Victoria, which started on the 15th of July. But Fitch expects a significantly lower take-up of loan deferrals this year than in 2020, as lenders have narrower criteria to access the programme. During the 2020 lockdowns, loan deferrals peaked at 7.9%. Fitch expects deferrals to be less than 1% this year, assuming lockdowns are eased by the end of October. Deferral programs were positive for mortgage arrears in 2020, and Fitch expects similar effects in the second half of 2021. The recovery in home prices remained strong in the second quarter, with Australia's eight capital cities recording the highest quarterly increases in more than a decade of 6.2%. Prices rose by 12.4% year over year, as all capital cities registered growth, six at double digits, Fitch said. And they expect price rises to slow throughout the rest of 2021 due to increasing affordability constraints. Fitch expects losses from the sale of collateral property to stay low due to a recovering economy and strong home price growth. Conditional prepayment rates for non-bank transactions at 27.2% remained higher than those issued by banks, most likely due to borrowers refinancing at lower fixed interest rates. Now, the increasing cost of building materials is jeopardising first home buyers' finances in New Zealand, according to a Radio New Zealand story, and I think it mirrors what's going on here too. The rapid rise in the price of materials such as bricks, timber and steel of up to 50% in the past year is pressurising builders to invoke escalation clauses within so-called fixed price contracts, they said. A lawyer warns that there is no such thing as a fixed price contract and buyers need to be beware. Master Builders is warning companies not to remove clauses in contracts that allow them to raise prices even after signing a deal. For example, Lucy McPherson, 25, and her partner Ben Butterick signed up in July for a $545,000 build yet to begin in Selwyn near Christchurch. They thought that by going rural, they had got a good deal on a four-bedroom house and land package, but already the price has risen by $7,000 and the sleepless nights have kicked in. You just don't know what to do, McPherson, who works in marketing, said. If what they end up paying breaches a cap of $550,000, they will not only have to pay the extra, but will also lose their Home Start grant. I just can't imagine having to finish your first home and then turn around and pay back not only extra costs that you didn't know were going to pop up, but also that Home Start grant, which is such a big help to first-time buyers like ourselves, she said. Their bank had pre-approved up to $550,000, but was strongly advising them not to go ahead. They gave us the very stern warning that they have seen many cases like this that have spiraled out of control, cases where cost overruns have hit $60,000 plus, McPherson said. A mortgage broker told RNZ about two similar size overruns that she'd seen recently in Auckland. If someone came up to me today and said, oh, I'm a first-time buyer, should I build new? I'd say, absolutely not. Don't even bother, McPherson said. You'll have your head in the ground for months and months and months dealing with all the craziness at the moment. We absolutely regret putting money into KiwiSaver also, they said. The couple is eligible to get the maximum $20,000 Home Start grant due to pouring all their savings into KiwiSaver. Years and years ago, we were sold this idea of KiwiSaver and how wonderful it was to put all this money into it for years and you'd be all set to go and buy your first house. Now KiwiSaver has just a chokehold around your neck, she said. We absolutely regret putting money into KiwiSaver for that purpose. Their builder has told them that Registered Master Builders Association's advice to him weeks ago was not to offer a fixed price job. The standard Master Builders contract has a provision covering price fluctuations, but builders have been known to remove it. Master Builders Association Chief Executive David Kelly has warned against that. We recommend builders exercise caution before removing those clauses given the current environment, Kelly said in a statement. Global disruption, forcing up material costs, was making it very difficult to determine exactly how much a build would cost. The key for builders is to communicate and be upfront and honest with their customers, provide realistic timelines and cost structures, and talk openly about the risk. Then together you can manage this. However, Christchurch property lawyer Prue Miller said home buyers were bearing too much of the risk without realising it. She said she's even had to tell banks that the regular fixed price contracts that they demanded from customers almost always allowed for cost adjustments. There is and has never been such a thing as a fixed price residential build contract, she said. Previously, Miller would strike out any escalation clauses she came across and builders would never argue, but the goalposts were shifting. Now they certainly would argue, Kelly said. Buyers should talk to their builder and designer and be clear about their budget. McPherson has been told they can come in under $550,000 if they build only two or three bedrooms, not four, but she worries that this would give the builder license to go up to the maximum of $550,000. There's kind of no protection. It's so uncertain. Months ago, we were being encouraged to build more houses, blah, blah, blah. Now, it's been made so hard. And elsewhere, the unravelling Chinese credit impulse foretold the stalling of the global reflation trade. So the question now is this a pause that refreshes, or will we go for a rerun of a decade ago? Asked Albert Edwards from Societe Generale. For back in 2011, a bubble of reflation enthusiasm burst and bond yields quickly slumped from 3.75% to 1.75%. That's a new ice age low. Over recent months, as real bond yields revisited record negative lows and break-even inflation expectations retreated from near to recent highs, equity sector rotation has reflected these changes, with growth stocks regaining their footing relative to value stocks. Investors are grappling with one key fundamental issue, the $64,000 question, really. Namely, are we merely experiencing a temporary pause in the new secular reflation trade, i.e. the Great Melt, or are we, as in the aftermath of the GFC, once again succumbing to the gravitational pull of deflation, i.e. the Ice Age? Despite the surge in headline and core inflation rates around the world, the investment jury is still out on this issue, he said. If it is the latter, more of the Ice Age, investors will see a repeat of the multiple QE interventions, which will drive bond yields to yet new lows, and the equity markets overall and other sectors to explore ever more extreme multiples. Anyone who demonstrates confidence in the outcome to this question is likely to be either a charlatan or a central banker, or both, he said. I wrestle with starkly contrasting and firmly held views, yet the situation emerging from the pandemic is unprecedented and extremely hard to predict. To be clear, he says, my own view is that we are shifting away from the Ice Age. This means we will see higher highs in bond yields by the end of this cycle, i.e. higher than the 3.25% 10-year high of the last cycle, seen in October 2018, but not before we see another major growth and deflation scare. Shorter term, earlier this year, we highlighted the slump in the China credit impulse. The credit impulse is the second derivative of the stock of credit, i.e. it's the change in the changing credit growth. Andreas Stenner-Larsen calls this chart the chart of charts. It's certainly food for thought and suggests the reflation trade might unravel for a while yet. What is certainly true, whichever chart you look at, is that the current decline in the credit impulse is steeper than at the time of the infamous end 2018 Powell pivot. And Morgan Stanley warns that equity market internals have continued to follow a mid-cycle transition, a process that usually ends up with quality stocks, market generals getting hit, which poses outside risk to the high-quality S&P 500 through October, they said. This is a continuation of their long-running theme that the US economy is undergoing a mid-cycle transition. As part of this mid-cycle transition, several months ago, the bank urged clients to transition out of small caps and into quality stocks. We are now on the verge of ending the mid-cycle transition, which ends either in fire with a market correction of 10 to 20%, as a result of higher rates, or ICE, as consumer spending grinds to halt. They said that, firstly, in September and October, this represents a tricky period for central bank communication, economic data, and market technicals. The bank sees risks to both US equities and US bonds given current valuations, and as a result, Morgan Stanley is downgrading US stocks to underweight and global equities to equal weight. For the global economy, Morgan Stanley thinks that many current inflationary pressures are temporary, but the timing of peak inflation varies by region and country. On growth, the bank believes that we've passed the peak in activity, with August particularly weak in the US, but the end of the cycle is not nigh. In terms of rates, it will come as no surprise that Morgan Stanley thinks that core rates have bottomed and will move higher into the fourth quarter of 21 and into the second half of 22. After all, this is the biggest consensus trade across Wall Street, and is thus likely to be wrong. Central bank withdrawal of policy accommodation and near-term troughs in economic data should both help to push yields higher. And also, they think the US dollar will grind higher into the end of the year. And for equities, they warn that market internals have continued to follow a mid-cycle transition. That process usually ends with quality stocks getting hit, which poses outsized risks to the high-quality S&P 500. Both fire, rates higher, and ICE, the growth slowdown is worse than expected, pose risks to a market that has barely derated year-to-date. We're going to have a period where data is going to be weak in September at the time when you have a heightened risk of Delta variant and schools reopening, adding that if the data does stay soft, the market valuations just haven't adjusted like other parts of the market have. Yet, JP Morgan saw retail investors as the key force behind recent gains, noting that they ploughed almost $30 billion of cash into US stocks and ETFs in July and August, the most in a two-month period. And it is these retail investors whose performance has trounced that of hedge funds in the past 2 years that could also be the support pillar that keeps the market stable as long as easy money policies persist. At least according to JP Morgan, retail investors have been buying stocks and equity funds at such a steady and strong pace that makes an equity correction looking rather unlikely, JP Morgan Global Strategies wrote recently. Whether the coming Fed policy change changes retail investor attitudes towards equities remains to be seen. So far this year, retail investors have been buying stocks and equity funds at such a steady and strong pace that makes an equity correction look rather unlikely, adding that whether the upcoming Fed policy change changes retail investor attitudes toward equities remains to be seen. So they conclude that the risk of an equity correction remains low. As such, monitoring this retail flow on a daily and weekly basis is key to the equity market outlook. And as Zero Hedge put it, since JP Morgan knows this, the Fed certainly knows this, even the smallest market hiccup will prompt a furious response from the Fed because we are now well beyond the point of no return and Jerome Powell and company simply cannot afford even the smallest drop in stocks without risking a full-blown market meltdown. Hence the crossroads. And here's another one from Goldman's. Treasury Secretary Yellen sent a letter to congressional leaders this morning indicating that the Treasury will exhaust its cash and extraordinary measures during the month of October. This is in line with our expectations, though slightly sooner than the October or November timing that the Congressional Budget Office had estimated in a report in late July. There are several ways the debt limit could play out. The most likely scenario is that Democratic leaders will attach a debt limit suspension to upcoming spending legislation to keep the federal government open past the end of the fiscal year, a continuing resolution, and to provide emergency disaster relief funding related to the fires in the western US and storm damage in the eastern South. As 46 Senate Republicans have indicated they will block a debt limit increase, there's a good chance this strategy will not succeed. That said, passage of short-term debt limits may be possible as several Republican senators represent states affected by recent disasters. One option Republicans may consider would be to vote against the bill but decline to filibuster it, allowing it to pass with only 51 votes in the Senate. That would likely require unanimous Democratic support in that chamber, which is possible but not certain. If Senate Republicans block the spending bill later this month, Democratic leaders would then need to decide whether to force the issue and risk a partial federal government shutdown or to remove the debt limit suspension from the spending bill. If lawmakers end up in a stalemate, a government shutdown might follow, though we do not see this as the base case, they said. If they're unable to raise the debt limit as part of a spending bill, they might consider using the reconciliation process to pass it with only 51 votes. However, this faces two challenges. First, it's unclear whether all Senate Democrats would vote for a revised budget resolution that increases the debt limit by several trillion dollars. And if Democrats use the reconciliation process, Senate rules would probably allow them only to raise the debt limit by a specific dollar figure, which would lead to more politically problematic headlines, rather than suspend it for a period of time, which has become the norm over the past decade, as it does not lead to a specific dollar amount at the time of passage. Second, the current reconciliation process to pass as much as $3.5 trillion in new spending is already underway, with House committees already in the process of considering and passing their segments of the bill in committee. Revising the budget resolution, which governs that process, could interfere with consideration of that legislation, and it would likely take at least a couple of weeks, if not longer. If Democrats wait until the September 30 deadline to test support for a debt limit increase as part of the spending bill, they might not have sufficient time to go through all of the procedures necessary to revise the resolution before the debt limit deadline. And yet more crossroads. Bloomberg says the proliferation of COVID-19 variants in Africa, partly attributed to the low rates of vaccination on the continent, could lead to vaccine-evading mutations that complicate attempts to end the pandemic, a group of 112 African and 25 international organizations have said. A study of genomics from 33 African nations and two overseas territories published in the journal Science on Thursday track the evolution of the pandemic across the continent and the emergence of a number of so-called variants of concern and variants of interest. One of these, Beta, spread around the globe earlier this year and rendered some vaccines partially ineffective. The slow rollout of vaccines in most African countries creates an environment in which the virus can replicate and evolve, the organisation said. This will almost certainly produce additional VOCs, any of which could derail the global fight against COVID-19. While more than half of the population of the US and over 60% of the people living in the European Union are fully vaccinated, just 3.2% of Africa's 1.2 billion people have been fully dosed. That's resulted in a severe third wave of infections in many countries and the emergence of a new variant in South Africa known as C.1.2. The study showed that COVID-19 was introduced into most African nations from Europe, and in turn the continent has exported the variant it spawned back to European countries. Different strains of the virus spread around the continent, mainly from South Africa, Nigeria and Kenya, three of the African countries with the strongest links to the wider world. The Beta variant, identified in South Africa in December, quickly raced as far north as the Democratic Republic of Congo, mostly likely along the road and rail routes that connect the country's ports with the subcontinent, the study said. The research is the first major output by Africa's leading scientists in an effort to increase the continent's ability to produce and analyse genomic data. Two variants of West Africa and East Africa, known as B1.5.2.5 and A.23.1, need to be contained, it said. There is strong evidence that both of these VOIs are rising in frequency in the region where they have been detected, which suggests that they may possess higher fitness than other variants, the scientist said. Although more focused research on the biological properties of these VOIs is needed to confirm whether they could be considered VOCs, it would be prudent to assume the worst. The study was done in cooperation with the World Health Organization and the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention. If the virus keeps evolving on the African continent, this will become a global problem, said a professor who helped put the study together and who runs gene sequencing institutions at two South African universities. It is our moral duty to try to protect Africa and the world. And finally, President Joe Biden said he'd order all executive branch employees, federal contractors and millions of healthcare workers to be vaccinated against the coronavirus, and that his administration would issue rules requiring large private employers to mandate shots or testing. The new measures were Biden's response to a resurgent COVID-19 pandemic driven by the Delta variant of the virus and by tens of millions of Americans who have refused to be vaccinated. Federal employees who don't comply could be dismissed, the administration said, and private employers might be fined. Biden also delivered some of his harshest criticism yet of the 25% of US adults who've so far not been inoculated, saying that they're dragging out the pandemic that has claimed more than 650,000 lives in the US. My message to unvaccinated Americans is this: what more is there to wait for? What more do you need to see? He said. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost us all. So please do the right thing. His latest plan, the president said, would combat those blocking public health and also protects our economy and will make our kids safer in schools. The directive marks a significant hardening of the administration's position on vaccine mandates amid the surge by the Delta variant that threatens to overwhelm hospitals in parts of the US. Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, the largest union for federal workers, voiced support for vaccines, but also indicated that the new order should be negotiated with the labor groups. Workers deserve a voice in their working conditions, Kelly said in a statement. The Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, a voluntary group, called the move misguided. Vaccination should be promoted through education and encouragement, not coercion, President Larry Kazumi said in a statement. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said it would carefully review the details of the announcement and will press for businesses to have the resources, guidance and flexibility necessary. And the Business Roundtable welcomed Biden's vigilance and said it looks forward to continuing to work with the administration and leaders across all levels of government to defeat the pandemic. So standing back, whether you think about vaccines, whether you think about COVID variants, whether you think about the future direction of the stock market, up or down or sideways, and indeed what you think about house prices and mortgage delinquencies, there are choices everywhere. The point is, though, there is not enough information on the table to be definitive about where things go from here and which of those roads are the most promising. So the best we can say is continue to watch the data and see how this all plays out. But I would remind you that statistically speaking, stock markets have tended to correct during September and October if they do correct within a calendar year. So it is worth continuing to be cautious, at least for the next couple of months. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.